Morning, everyone.
This is the commencement of the House Special Committee on Budget Subcommittee on Human Services and Public Safety, Tuesday, June 21st, 2005. Today, we will be dealing with House Bill 5140, the Department of Human Services, and we'll be speaking most specifically to the cluster relating to children, adults, and families. And we'll begin with Ms. Baker.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I do have extra copies in case the memos didn't get to you.
No, I have it, but it's on my desk. Thank you.
I was assuming it would change.
This one didn't.
Excellent.
Okay, so this is House Bill 5148, continuing that discussion with the Department of Human Services budget. The cluster we're working on today is children, adults, and families. Again, the memo and the spreadsheet were provided to you earlier, and today I handed out a policy package summary similar to what you saw yesterday for department-wide support services. So we may talk about that in more detail. The top of the memo shows the comparative budget information again for this children, adults, and families cluster. I would note that this particular cluster, because of reorganization and how the budgets have been structured, it's kind of hard to compare apples and apples for previous years because, for example, for the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget, at the start of the 2003-05 biennium, that budget included some of the, or that number would have included both the children, adults, and families budget plus the community services budget, which was the field staffing piece. That field staffing piece included not only staff related to children, adults, and families program, but also staff related to seniors and people with disabilities. And that's transferred out now and in the governor's recommended and our LFO recommended budget. But if you're looking for comparison numbers, sometimes those other SPD staffing pieces are in there. And so I would just caution you in terms of comparison. But looking at in terms of where the budget has increased, particularly you'll note the federal funds non-limited has jumped about $100 million from the 03-05 legislatively approved to the 05-07 recommended, and that is all food stamp benefit payments. So it's a significant increase, but that particular funding source, it's non-limited for a reason because it's an entitlement program and we don't necessarily have control over those benefit expenditures, but it is a substantial part of their budget, and it has increased about $100 million. Some of the other areas of increase include mandated caseloads, and we'll have some further discussion about mandated caseloads. Some, for budget building purposes, some caseloads are considered to be mandated. That is, they're considered to be an automatic build into the budget. Some are considered to be non-mandated, which means they don't have a guarantee to be built into the budget initially. Now, with any caseload, the governor or the legislature can decide not to fund parts of that. But for budget building purposes, it's a determination of which caseloads sort of get a gimme into the initial budget and which don't. And again, we'll talk about that in more detail. And you will note that the general fund is up about $50 million from 03-05. Part of that is mandated caseload, as I mentioned. Another part of it is there's about $16 million in fund shifts in this budget to general fund from federal funds because in the 03-05 period, there were significant carry-forwards of federal revenues that had to be backed out because they're not available this biennium. At this point, we're not estimating they're available this biennium, and so they're backfilled with general fund. The other major issue in this budget, $16 million in fund shifts. For example, the department carried forward some additional temporary assistance to needy families, TANF funding, into 03-05 and reduced the general fund for that period for that reason. They also carried forward federal social services block grant funding, which is a very fungible social services federal grant, and we use that interchangeably with general fund. So when they carried forward those additional monies from those fund sources, they backed out the general fund. For 05-07, we're not expecting that those a similar kind of carry forward in that amount would be available, and so we backed out that federal money and replaced it with general fund. The other major cost driver in this budget is inflation, because so much of this budget goes out in special payments in terms of client benefits or provider benefits. There is a significant amount of inflation in the budget, even with the governor's budget reduction, moving that downward. So those are the major reasons for the differences. And you'll see, if you look at the governor's recommended staffing positions and the LFO recommended staffing positions, there's a significant decrease there, and that's a result of a reshoot adjustment, some transfers out that we'll talk about in a little more detail later. So the recommended changes to the governor's budget, I've summarized there. Again, it includes things based on the reshoot that the agency submitted, the technical changes for the PERS and the Attorney General rates, the House budget actions that add back program reductions that the governor made, and we'll talk about those in more detail, the elimination of the policy package in the governor's budget to increase Attorney General representation for child welfare workers, and then the services and supplies and capital outlay general fund 3% reduction. And I note that although the policy package related to the Attorney General representation is eliminated, the House budget does call for a $2.5 million special purpose appropriation to the emergency board so that a plan can be agreed on and the agency can come in to get additional funding to address the issues that were related to that policy package, so the child welfare staffing and the legal representation needs. And we did receive a copy of a revised plan. I got my copy last Friday. Haven't had time to analyze it, and I don't think that members who got that additional material have had a chance to look at it or discuss it as well. But we do have a revised plan. We haven't reviewed it. There's been no agreement reached on it. And we may have some discussion later on that issue. And then there's, again, the other tweaky changes that the LFO analyst recommends to this budget. So at this point, I'd like to go through the spreadsheet and talk about some of the line items, and then we can talk about page 3 of the spreadsheet, which identifies some issues that aren't included in either the governor's budget, the reshoot budget, or our recommended budget. So on page 1 of the spreadsheet, then, again, I've tried to set this up so that you have caseload costs and revenue issues, changes to the governor's budget, which is on line 1, then other revisions to the governor's budget. And at the bottom of page 1, you see the agency's total reshoot request. So these reshoot adjustments affect self-sufficiency programs, child welfare programs, the vocational rehabilitation programs, and then the program support and central administration functions that are all within this budget cluster. So the first two items relate to the non-limited federal funds, food stamp increase. So these are the food stamp benefit, the projected need, although it's a non-limited expenditure and it's not budgeted for in the sense that operational costs are budgeted for. The agency does track those and submits a number that they think will cover their non-limited needs for the biennium. So the 2 and 3 relate to that. It's a total of over $80 million additional non-limited federal funds. And those of you who were in the Joint Human Services Subcommittee remember that the benefits are non-limited. There's no general fund match associated with those. But the staffing costs for the eligibility workers for the food stamp cases is a 50-50 general fund and federal fund cost. So we do track that and watch what's happening with that program. Item four is a food stamp penalty. And we talked about food stamp error rates during the budget discussions. What happens is that the federal government tracks both up and down, that is, both errors that give people more money than they should get and errors that give people less money than they should get. And relative to other states, even though Oregon has been improving its error rates, other states have as well. And so we're in a penalty situation. In some years in the past, the federal government has allowed us to take that money and reinvest it into improvements for the food stamp error rates. This time around, they're asking for the cash up front, and so it's shown here as a general fund cost. The agency is making efforts to continue to improve the food stamp error rates and talking with the feds about how they're going to do that. And hopefully, if we are in a penalty situation in the future, they'll be able to, again, reinvest that into some additional improvements.
Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be helpful. This is the penalty for 2002. I would certainly appreciate seeing the potential liabilities for 03 and 04, if not. Certainly, 05 is not done yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, my understanding, and the agency can confirm this, is that there wouldn't be any penalty for federal fiscal year 2003 because the feds have changed how they're calculating the error rate, and so basically everybody gets a pass for that year. But I believe that there is some potential liability for 2004, and let me see if I can find the number there. $772,000 is an estimate, but my understanding is as well that there's still ongoing negotiations about that amount.
Thank you.
Would you respond to whether or not that is just the way it is, meaning that the federal requirements are such that it's very, very difficult to comply, or is this a systemic problem within the agency that is going to continue to cost $600,000 or $700,000 a year, in which case we need to have some focused attention?
Mr. Chair, I guess what I would say is the agency has been working and has dropped its error rates significantly. The issue is how we compare with other states' error rates. Part of what was done in the staffing study and some of the recommendations that are made there may be able to help the agency improve their error rates as well. It's an ongoing issue with the federal government because it is something they track, and I suspect, although I haven't heard anything official, but I suspect that they're cracking down a little more on the error rates than they did in the past. The flip side of that is if you look again at the amount of food stamps benefits that are being paid out, in order to increase outreach and provide food stamps to people, if you worry too much about the error rate, you're not going to get the benefits out to those who do indeed qualify for it. So it's sort of an ongoing tension from my perspective about how much do you outreach and try to get food stamps out versus how much you crack down on the upfront eligibility and the processing. Not to say that you want to ignore what's happening in terms of eligibility determination, but obviously the more food stamps that you're giving out, the greater your chance of error in determining someone's eligibility. And again, part of the issue is it's not just was this person eligible or was this person not eligible. I believe part of it is how much are they eligible for. So even if a person is eligible and they're determined to be eligible, if they're given, you know, $20 too much in food stamps, then the state could be determined to be in a, that would be an error for purposes of the error rate determination. So it's not only a yes or no decision, it's a how much decision that factors into that error rate calculation.
Well, one, I would think one other aspect of this is if we look back at the way we budgeted over the last couple bienniums, we've got a huge increase in the amount of the number of people getting the benefit. Caseloads have went through the roof. We haven't made investments in training. Hopefully we'll get caught up at some point in the technology, but that puts a lot of stress on the system, and I don't think we've invested wisely in either people or technology, and I don't think we're going to make any dramatic turnarounds this time, and it's real complicated in terms of how eligibility is provided. I mean, if there's a mistake in the calculations of somebody's shift differential pay, that can throw the benefit amount off. And whether, you know, and some of that's relatively complex to get to. And we've had a lot of PERS retirements, a lot of people moving up, working out in class without the training that would come along with it. So this is going to be an ongoing problem.
The staffing study certainly emphasized also the antiquated computer system that we've got for food stamps, the need to bring that up, and the idea of certifying and qualifying and coordinating those between different programs.
On line 5, a nice segue into the staffing study as well. In the staffing study, there was an identification that although the staffing study didn't directly review the temporary assistance to needy families staffing, it did review food stamps and Medicaid eligibility, and it noted in that review that although there was a need based on their proposed initial staffing workload standards, a need for some additional eligibility positions, that there were probably too many TANF case managers, at least at the existing staffing standards. And the department had started to reclassify some of these positions in the governor's budget, but this moves that forward even more, so that there's a total of 160 positions being reclassified here. There's not a lot of savings because the position pay scales overlap, if you will. So it's only a small differential between a social service specialist 3 and a TANF case manager position. So you don't get a lot of dollar savings because of that. But over time, it both puts people into a more appropriate position, and over time it would save some money.
So the staffing study was merely saying that it's a classification issue and not a utilization of personnel issue?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would characterize it as both, that this particular one, what was happening out in the field was that there was a need for additional staff on the eligibility side, and that there were, at least in their estimation, at the current standards, too many TANF case managers. So, in effect, some of those case managers were doing some eligibility work. So out on the ground, they had already made the shift, in part, to have people doing the work that needed to be done. But this trues up their budget for that reclassification position.
You said both. So that deals with reclassification, but what about...
Well, the workload issue, as the staffing study did not say that they don't need the the 160 positions. They said they needed some additional eligibility positions. This gets the positions in the right place, I guess. And I see that as a mix of how you use the positions and the classifications. Okay, line six, the Federal Refugee Assistance Program, that federal funding level is being increased, and so that's reflected here. That is 100% federal funds. There's no general fund costs associated with that. Line seven, this is related to the Child Welfare Title IV-E waiver. This is an agreement with the federal government that we can use federal 4E, which is foster care and adoption assistance funds, in a little more flexible way than you could without the waiver, so that you can use it more for preventive services and keeping kids from going into foster care. That waiver had initially expired and now has been renewed. Part of the waiver requirement is that that there be an evaluation of that. And so the contract has been with Portland State University, but the contract wasn't fully funded in the governor's budget for continuation of the waiver since the waiver hadn't been renewed at that point. So these are the additional costs associated with that. It's a 50-50 general fund, federal fund cost. Line 8 relates to adoptions, assistance, and other programs. In the adoption assistance area, adoptions assistance is the major one. There's about $2.7 million of savings there, and I'll talk about that a little more in a minute in terms of mandated and non-mandated caseloads, but in the reshoot, they included $2.7 million of general fund savings related to that and $5.3 million of total fund savings. Those savings are offset in part on the federal fund side by some increased federal funds for post-adoption support, so helping to keep adoptive placements in place and working. And that's a federal fund piece that's in that line as well. Line 9 reflects the Medicaid and the foster care and adoption assistance match rate change. We talked about that a little bit yesterday in department-wide support services budget. So the federal funds are picking up a little more of the share of the costs for those programs in the children, adults, and families budget. So that's shown there. Item 10 is a carry forward from the May 05 rebalance, so House Bill 5077. There was a double count in their other funds revenue, and so that was corrected in that rebalance for 03-05. But it was also carried forward into 05-07 in the governor's budget, so it has to be corrected there as well. Line 11 relates to a new vocational rehabilitation competitive employment grant. The application was approved, as noted there, at the June 4th meeting of the emergency board. The grant has been awarded, and so we've established the federal funds there. Line 12 is worthy of a few moments of discussion. These are some additional federal funds that the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program has collected over time, funds that have already been matched. They've already had the general fund match, and so they're available for expenditure now without any additional general fund. And it's about $5 million, and the plan for the agency would be to use those in part for some client services, but also it's all for client service ultimately, but one part for direct client services for caseloads that they're dealing with, and then the other part would be to make some what they're calling strategic investment projects with their community partners to help leverage additional other funds over time that can be used to match federal funds.
Is this from Jobs Plus?
This is not related to Jobs Plus.
Money?
No. The money is from the Vocational Rehabilitation Program in the past where they've used general fund to match federal funds, but then haven't used all of the federal funds that came back as a result of that.
I'm trying to figure which line, where this was at.
Right. It's a different line than Jobs Plus. It's the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program. And if you want to have the agency come up and talk in more detail about that. It is a significant issue in the fact that it is a lot of additional federal funds that wasn't in the governor's budget. However, our assessment is that on the vocational rehabilitation side, first of all, the governor's budget cut that general fund significantly. The House budget does add all of the special payments back for that, so that is helpful. But even at that level, there are additional people out there that they could serve if they had, particularly if they had community support and could leverage some ongoing funds. An example of that would be their existing school transition program, where they work with local school districts to use the school district's money to leverage this federal fund, which is at a significantly enhanced match rate, but they leverage that and provide services for those youth to help those youth in school and then transfer or transition to employment. Okay, line 13. This is a correction of a package in the governor's budget that rolls forward the November 2004 budget rebalance plan. In that package, they forgot to take out $3.2 million of other fund limitation from child care and development fund monies that this agency receives from the employment department. And so there was empty limitation, and it needed to be corrected there. Lines 14 through 17 reflect changes to the governor's budget package that made programmatic and staffing reductions in the agency. And there are several line items there. The first one doesn't have a fiscal impact, but I wanted to note it because it does shift how much money comes from where. The governor's budget anticipated a total of $3.4 million general fund reduction based on using funds from the Jobs Plus individual education accounts and the law enforcement medical liability account. However, the individual education account, the monies that are available in that, were not sufficient to cover both the transfer that DHS anticipated and a transfer to the Student Assistance Commission that the governor's budget anticipated. So there was basically $300,000 less going to be available in the individual education account than was needed to make both of those transfers. So they've reduced how much they believe they'll be able to transfer from the Jobs Plus individual education account, and there is enough in the law enforcement medical liability account now to cover that additional $300,000. So, again, no net fiscal impact, but the amounts that are being changed or that are being transferred from each of those have changed. Now, those particular transfers require statutory authority, not just the budget limitation. And so you will see at some point what we call a program change bill that will include those two transfers from those accounts, because the statutes do not, in their current form, make those transfers to Department of Human Services.
On the medical liability account, will there still be a significant enough balance to maintain that program, or are we closing it out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the expectation is that there will be enough balance there to continue to pay claims against that account. I don't know that there's not a large balance, but based on the expenditures and the projections to date, they think they'll be okay. They're not closing the account down.
It's been a long time since I worked on that, back in olden county days. What's the source of the funding for that account?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the source of the funding, is from monies that are paid by the courts into that account, and the expenditures are used to cover where law enforcement injures someone in the act of apprehending them. So, for example, if they're after someone and they break the person's leg and they have to go to the hospital and there's charges related to that, then that account is used to pay for that.
Okay. So
Okay.
So
it's excess funds, the account stays open.
Right. Over time, the balances have, the revenue coming in has exceeded the expenditures being paid out. So I guess that's a good thing that there aren't as many claims as otherwise there might be. Line 15 is just a correction. When the governor's budget took out $1 million general fund from the, this is the employment and training program related to the food stamps program. When the governor's budget took out $1 million general fund, there also should have been a similar reduction on the federal fund side, and so this corrects for that. Then the governor's budget also cut, independent of the Title IV waiver evaluation costs that we talked about above, there's some additional costs that were being paid to Portland State University related to child welfare research, and that cut needed to be repriced. The amount that was cut in this instance wasn't enough in terms of general fund. And then line 17, this relates to the governor's budget reduction of vocational rehabilitation services. The stated intent was to make a 20% reduction in that, and in fact, the actual reduction that was made was about a third of the general fund in that program. So here, this is adding back $700,000 general fund and the related federal funds to get to what the governor's budget originally intended, which was a 20% reduction. Now, you'll see later on that based on the House plan, we're fully restoring those special payments reductions. So, in effect, this reduction in the reshoot saved $700,000 general fund that otherwise you would have spent in the House plan to add this back. Package 129 on line 18, we talked about this a little bit in department-wide support services yesterday as well. This is the Medicaid quality control review, the new federal regulations in terms of reviewing those cases. And again, based on what other states have done relative to this and their experience in terms of staffing needs, there's some additional staffing that are requested there. And again, if you go to this package summary, you can see the adjustments in that package and the other packages. But this is at the towards the bottom of the page again, so you can see that the total package ends up being almost $600,000 general fund, a similar amount of federal funds in 12 positions. So it is a significant increase, but it's a significant requirement that the feds are imposing there. So on line 20, line 19, technical adjustments and transfers. In this budget, the transfers are a net reduction of over $9 million general fund and over $13 million total funds, and 136 positions. So as we talked about yesterday, 80 of those are going to department-wide support services for the collection and recovery efforts. The other pieces go to other parts of the budget for other things, but they're trying to true up based on how the positions are functioning and where the appropriate budget structure is for those positions. So
they're going out of the cluster.
They're going out of this cluster, right. Some are going to department-wide support services. I'll have to check, but I believe some are going to health services and then some to SPD. So as we saw yesterday, a big increase in department-wide support services. There's a big reduction in the children, adults, and families budget cluster. And this was what I talked about initially in terms of the significant staffing reduction. Most of that is attributed to these transfers out.
Can I just ask a quick question before we start on the second page there? On line 8, I'm still not clear on, it looks like it's a reduction in federal funds there, but it says on the thing that adds federal funds for...
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, what is shown there is the net federal funds change, which is a reduction. That federal funds reduction would have been more, except that there are some federal funds being added for post-adoption support.
Oh,
an offset.
Right, it's an offset.
Offset, okay. All right, thanks.
Okay, page 2 of 3. Line 21 and 22 reflect the PERS rate reductions and the Attorney General rate reductions for this cluster. Line 23 is general fund backfill for tobacco tax revenue. Historically, there has been a little bit of tobacco tax funding in this cluster. It originated with the staffing related to Measure 44 back in the 90s. At this point, the expectation would be that that tobacco tax revenue would continue. That was the expectation in the governor's budget. In fact, in doing their revenue projections, the tobacco tax revenue in the Office of Medical Assistance Program basically used all the tobacco tax revenue in that area. And so what we're doing is recognizing that there is, in fact, no tobacco tax revenue available for the CAF budget, and we're using general fund to backfill that. Now, 24 and 25 and 27 relate to the mandated program discussion. As we talked about in budget building, some programs are considered to be mandated, some are not. In the children, adults, and families budget, foster care is a mandated program. Supportive remedial daycare has been considered a mandated program because it would, if it was not funded, the idea is that those children, the foster care costs would increase. So it's an offset, if you will, to foster care costs. But those two on the child welfare side are considered to be mandated. Adoptions assistance payments are considered to be mandated. And so what I'm doing in 24, 25, and 27 is say, budgetarily, we need to get the numbers aligned with what is mandated and what is not mandated, and then talk about, for what is not mandated, what's not funded, which is on page 3 of this. But so those adjustments there say, line 24 says, supportive remedial daycare is mandated. It should have been funded in the governor's budget or the reshoot at the projected level, and so I'm adding funds there. Similarly, but in on the reverse, the reshoot should not, or should have added, let me see, should have adjusted for regular foster care and the one-time foster care payments, but in this case it's a reduction because the caseload is a little less than had been projected in the governor's budget. But again, that's a mandated caseload, so we go up and down depending on what the current projections are. And then on line 27, the number that you saw for the adoptions reduction, actually for the mandated caseload for adoptions assistance, the reduction is a little more than what was reflected, and the increases were in the other adoption programs. So we take an additional reduction there. So basically the effect of those adjustments, it's a little bit of a general fund increase for the agency, about $20,000 general fund increase for the agency, but the idea is to say, if the policy is to say this is mandated or this is not mandated, then the budget adjustments should separate out the mandated from the non-mandated caseload. So that's what's happening there. And then in line 26, the substitute care independent living program, this is not a mandated caseload, but it is federal funded. There are additional federal funds. This is to help foster care kids transition out to living on their own for once they leave foster care. It's a federal grant, and there's $954,000 additional money available. So even though that's not a mandated caseload, I am recommending that part be funded. Okay, now moving down to line 28. The governor's recommended budget anticipated or recommended that the criminal fines and assessment account monies all be put into the general fund, and that programs that were previously funded with the criminal fines and assessment account monies would instead be funded with general fund. The legislature has disagreed with that as a policy choice, and so we're reversing that fund shift. There's no programmatic impact from this, from the governor's budget funding level. This relates to the domestic violence and sexual assault victims fund programs within CAF. Again, no program adjustment, just where the funds come from. So this shifts it back to criminal fines and assessment account funding. Okay, line 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, all are program add-backs that are called for in the House budget and in the Senate budget as well, to restore funding for those program reductions that were made in the governor's budget. So I won't go into laborious detail about all of them because we have talked some in the joint subcommittee about those reductions, but the funding for the TANF no parent household, where children are getting the TANF grant but they're staying with parents who might not otherwise qualify, staying with non-parents who might not otherwise qualify for TANF assistance, this continues that assistance for the children, eliminates the income limit that was proposed in the governor's budget. The governor's budget proposed limiting the employment-related daycare program to only those people leaving TANF, and this restores that $11.2 million general fund. The governor's budget proposed eliminating the reduced first-month copayment for people coming onto employment-related daycare, and so the House budget restores that reduction, $3.3 million general fund.
On number 30, would you explain why you have more FTEs than you have positions? Usually it's the other way around.
Mr. Chair, based on how this would be staffed, there are some partial FTE positions already in the budget, and although this would add FTE to some existing positions, it also has some new positions associated with it. So I guess the best way to explain it is already out there are some positions that are not full FTE positions. Their FTE would be increased to deal with the increased caseload related to this add back. That's why the FTE is higher. But they need 19 new positions, but they're also increasing FTE on some existing positions. So they don't need new authority for those positions that are already there. They do need funding and FTE authority to increase the FTE. So if you have a half-time FTE, for example, and it increases to three-quarter time or whatever, that would be part of the increased FTE, but you wouldn't get an additional position for that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Baker, I think I probably have the answer, but on 33, you're showing that that's a 1.0, and in the paperwork we'd received before, the add back was 1.7. Is that back to the previous page, the number 17? Is that the?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, that's it exactly.
Thank you.
The House budget called for a restoration of $1.7 million. The reshoot already covered the $0.7 million, and so line 33 restores the balance of that.
But so each co-chair has six. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Follow up. So I guess each chair has another $600,000. Is that good?
Absent any other pluses and minuses in their budget.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, jumping back for a minute to line 32, this is the restoration for the TANF domestic violence funding of $2.1 million. We talked about 33. I would note on 33 that this add back does get us back to above the federal maintenance of effort requirement for the vocational rehabilitation program. The governor's budget had brought us down below that. And this restores to where we're meeting that federal maintenance of effort requirement in terms of general fund expenditures. So that's a good thing, as well as the additional program services that it will provide. Line 34 relates to the system of care flexible funding. The governor's budget had cut that initially about 60% from where it was. There is some staffing that's related to system of care as well. This is the flexible funding piece, and so of the $4.5 million general fund that the governor's budget cut, this restores $3 million to bring the total funds to about $8.7 million. Line 35, the governor's budget proposed reducing special rates for foster care providers by $4.2 million general fund. The House budget restores that reduction, so basically keeps them as is. And so those add-backs, if you look on your package summary, I can find my package summary, okay. If you look in the 090 analyst adjustment package, the second one down, you can see the additional LFO recommended adjustments reflecting the House plan add back almost $27 million general fund of the $54 million reduction that the governor took. So basically has restored about half that package. Now, somewhere I made a note of what was still unfunded because I knew someone would ask that. Part of what is still unfunded in the governor's reductions is the $3.4 million fund shift that we talked about earlier. So $3.4 million general fund reduction, but it's fund shifted with money from the individual education account and the LEMLA. So that's not a program reduction, but it's reflected in that package. Some of the other pieces, the most significant is about $10.4 million of staffing and related administrative costs that the governor's budget did not fund in this budget and that the House budget doesn't fund either. There's the cost of living increase, which is about $3.6 million general fund. That was delayed until January 06 in the governor's budget. There's a $1.5 million reduction in general fund support for prevention programs, specifically abstinence education and the community safety net related to child welfare issues. $1.5 million for the two of those pieces. And then another significant reduction is in jobs, training, and support services. The $1 million in food stamps training support services that we talked about a little bit earlier, that's about $4.5 million between those two. So those are the major reductions that are still out there and unfunded. Oh, there's my notes. Okay. So then on line 36, this is the elimination of the governor's budget package for the AG representation for child welfare workers. As you can see, the House budget and the Senate budget both eliminate that. On line 39, the proposal is to appropriate $2.5 million to the emergency board as a special purpose appropriation. So when a plan is agreed on with DHS and Department of Justice and the legislative body, that DHS can come in and ask for what it needs out of that $2.5 million special purpose appropriation. At that point, any other funds or federal funds limitation related to that which they need, the emergency board can establish or increase their other and federal fund limitations for that. And similarly, to the extent that the Department of Justice would need other funds for its attorneys or other staff that it might be adding as a result of that, the limitation could be established for the Department of Justice as well. The Department of Justice would not get a special purpose appropriation because their funding would solely be paid through Department of Human Services. So the general fund is all in Department of Human Services. The other fund limitation would be in Department of Justice for the Department of Justice costs.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This 2.5, has that been discussed through the co-chair's level? Mm-hmm. It's here, but if this is new, is it not?
Well, yeah, they I don't know about co-chairs, but our the House chair and vice chair have discussed it, and the idea was that they brought forth another recommendation as of last Friday, but that it's too late in the process to change everything based on a letter. And so we do know that there's a need for investigation, and that whatever is not prepared, we have not been pleased with the recommendation. It's the nose under the tent issue. And so either there'll be better recommendations or else the money will just sit.
Yeah, I'll follow up on that because I was just looking to see if we, on line 36, Representative Hannah pointed out it's a 60-40 match. So this is about half of that piece of the, it's out of the general fund. So we wouldn't be getting any federal match on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, if there is federal match attached, we would expect that we would get some federal match when that general fund was ultimately allocated and spent, but the federal match attached to it would depend on how the package is configured and what those expenses are, but we would be able to add that to the budget at the time that they come in for the general fund.
Part of the reason that there is a federal match is that the idea that was originally proposed was a number of DOJ attorneys and then a number of paralegals, but that they would be placed through this budget and therefore would be able to be matched. Where so if it was just DOJ, they wouldn't.
So this, I'm just trying to get this, this is new to me too, but this 25, the $2.5 million will actually, if we figure out a way to utilize it, we'll be able to get some more with it. So
okay. If the utilization
if it
included positions that could be
matched. Right, okay.
And Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I would note that the letter that came in with the revised proposal had about a $2.3 million general fund cost associated with it.
Oh.
So this seems to be in the right realm in terms of order of magnitude. I would also note that the co-chairs have both the House and Senate budget anticipate this special purpose appropriation. So it is, there is agreement on this.
I'm always looking for extra money to come in if it's there, if that would help us.
I think
okay.
We'll go on.
Line 37, then, is the House budget's 3% reduction in services and supplies and capital outlay general fund expenditures. And in this budget, it is primarily services and supplies. There's very little capital outlay associated with it. So on the bottom of page 2, then, you see the what we're recommending for the total House preliminary budget and the special purpose appropriation to the emergency board. So the total of those, you can see, is a 3.22% increase in general fund and a 4.36% increase in total funds above where the governor's budget initially was. And that's obviously as a result of the funding added back. Now, on page 3, I did want to display for you things that weren't in the governor's original budget, aren't in the reshoot budget, and aren't in either the House or Senate budget plan. So you may have heard the number.
Thank you. Go back one step, please, Ms. Baker. The front sheet was showing a total budget of $2,275,000. Here we're showing $2,273,000.
Yes.
My question is, I guess, is the e-board obligated to spend that in this area, or you can spend that anywhere? Because that's the difference in the number on the front and this. But when we pass that budget, that gives us authority to spend in that area, but they don't have to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, you're right. The number on the front page of the memo includes the $2.5 million special purpose appropriation because in terms of overall budget picture and budget numbers, even though it's to the e-board initially instead of to the agency, we consider that as an expenditure for the big picture numbers. In terms of allocation, generally a special purpose appropriation to the emergency board will have a date by which the agency has to come in and ask for that money. And generally that date would be like January of 2007 if you want to give them the most amount of time to come in and get the money. After that date, or if they come in earlier and the emergency board doesn't allocate the full amount of funding that's set aside, then as of that date, the balance of it, or the whole appropriation if they don't use any of it, would go to the general purpose emergency fund. And so it's available then for any other general purpose expenditure of the emergency board, or general purpose allocation of the emergency board. If the emergency board doesn't allocate that, then at the end of the biennium, it goes into the ending balance for that biennium and then part of the beginning balance for the next biennium. So it is set aside, and that's the reason for the special purpose appropriation, is instead of just making them come in for part of the emergency board's general purpose pot of money, the special purpose appropriation does say this can only be used by, or this can only be allocated by the emergency board for this purpose. DHS can only come in for this money for this purpose. And so it does set some parameters about how the allocation can be used. But again, if it's not used in full or at all, the money will revert back to the general purpose emergency fund, and then after that, revert back to the general fund overall.
Thank you.
Page 3.
Page 3. I did want to highlight here these issues. You may have heard the number $25.4 million in caseload costs in the children, adults, and families budget. And that $25.4 million is the TANF issue, employment-related daycare, a little bit in child safety programs, and then in substitute care programs, and a little bit in adoption programs. So those five program areas make up the $25.4 million. So the
Person Henson.
Now that was what was referred to in the reshoot as the unmandated caseload?
Yes, Mr. Chair, okay. Representative Henson. This is the non-mandated caseload. Again, the governor and the legislature always have the ability to fund or not fund caseload, but for budget building purposes, this was not automatically in the budget to start with, and it was not included in the budget at any point in the process today. So you can see there that the major cost is in on the TANF side. The employment-related daycare costs, I would note, are as high as they are in part because during this current biennium there was a reduction in funding, and part of that reduction was the reduction made was more than it should have been, and so part of this is to backfill that reduction that was made. So you have a $7 million problem general fund in employment-related daycare relative to projected caseloads. Child safety program growth, there are just two small program pieces there, mutual home foster care and the housekeeper program. In substitute care, this is child welfare programs other than foster care and special rates foster care. Primarily residential treatment is the high-cost area here. Subsidized guardianship as well, which we heard was an alternative for some children when adoption isn't an alternative. And then other medical costs are the major components of the $5.5 million problem there. And then there's a couple of small other adoption programs that have some additional costs. So those are the pieces that make up the $25.4 million general fund. The other issue is that, if you remember, when the reshoot backed out $3.2 million of other funds of child care and development fund money that isn't being received, the agency, one of the proposals would be to backfill that with general fund, which would, they project, save a net $2 million in TANF and employment-related daycare cases, so that the net of the backfill cost would be $1.2 million general fund, and so that's shown here. I note it because that for next biennium, the agency would project $5 million general fund savings. So although there's a cost this biennium, their projection would be that there would be a savings next biennium. But again, this is not included in any of the either the House or Senate budget.
Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Baker, how will the department manage these reductions? Or, you know, if I don't know how to classify them, whether the reductions are non-existent increases, or but what's the net effect in terms of how do you reduce the caseload in this area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, you might, Mr. Chair, want to have the agency up to answer that, but I guess what I would say is that at some point, absent any other adjustments, when the money would run out, I would expect that the agency, because it's a limited pot of money, the agency would need to take some management actions either in this program area or in other program areas to offset these costs that aren't funded, if indeed the caseload comes in as projected. I would note that, I mean, this is a lot of money to rebalance in a tight budget, but there are opportunities sometimes in budget rebalancing to fund some of this caseload that might not be funded here. For example, we talked about the carry forward of TANF and social services block grant funds for 0305. That wasn't expected to happen for 0507. Well, if there is some carry forward of funds, $1 million, $2 million, whatever, that could help offset some of this in a future rebalance plan. So I guess at this point I would say my assessment is it's uncertain how the department would manage to this, and at least for the initial months of the year, it would probably take a wait-and-see approach before taking any management actions. But the ultimate bottom line would be to have to take some management actions to constrain those expenditures.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to hear from the department? This, you know, I would like to understand what the management options are, whether they're talking about waiting lists to get on TANF, a change in eligibility requirements, raising or lowering income limits, or I'd like to know what management tools would be available. Obviously, if you can find pots of money that you can use for that, that's a good management tool. But if short of that, I'd like to see what the impact is actually going to be on how the system works.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Yee.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director. And Representative Hansen, to your question, there are a limited range of possibilities, for instance, in the TANF program in terms of the reductions, which include either further narrowing the front door into which people come to be eligible for TANF, which is amongst the most narrow in the country at this point in terms of eligibility level limits. So we can further reduce that opening door or reduce payments or take another action similar to the one that you see restored here, which is for the No Parent in the Home grants in TANF to put an income limit on those, so affect one segment of the TANF population as opposed to the entire TANF population. But those really are the range of options. And I believe Ms. Baker is exactly correct that based on the size of this program, possibly as early as our first rebalance, or probably no later than our second rebalance, we would come back to you with that sort of range of option, or back to the emergency board with that sort of range of option to talk about how we would manage to the number.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right, so that takes care of the numbers portion. Is there any question on the numbers portion review by LFO? not, we can go to...
We'll jump back to page two of the memo to cover performance measures.
Performance measures, we've gone through these, and notice on the far right, we have same all the way down. There have been some references to targets and so forth on the page three, and these, you know, it's kind of reiterating things that we've gone over. Why don't we just take a moment and just look through them. If there's things that need to be brought up or gone into, we will, but performance measures is not as, I mean, it's something we've already worked through.
Yes.
So I don't spend a lot of time on it.
And Mr. Chair, I would note that the same refers to whether the measure itself is changing or not changing, and the proposals are to keep the measures the same, make some modifications in some of the targets based on what we heard from the agency earlier in the joint Human Services Subcommittee.
Anyone on the committee want to spend time going over specifics on the performance measures, or should we go to budget notes?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I was not part of the original Phase 1 and Phase 2 review, can you briefly just tell me number 14, is that a realistic target? Should it be lower? Did you talk about that much?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnut, there was some discussion in the joint subcommittee about that. Because that measure relates to re-abuse of children who already have been abused or were neglected, I think philosophically people thought that that target should be zero. But again, realistically, that wouldn't work. And so what I've noted here is that the department met its target in 2003, but that target was at 7.6. The national standard for that measure is 6.1%. And so I'm just suggesting that they revise it downward, especially given the potential improvements that could be made based on the $2.5 million special purpose appropriation, which ideally the outcomes of increased legal representation or the child welfare staffing issues, ideally the outcome would be improved safety for children. And so that's why I'm recommending that it be reduced downward some. I'm not sure that they could get to the $6.1 million national standard. I'm not sure if that's realistic. But somewhere between 6.1 and 7.5, I think, is where that target ought to be.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, follow up.
I think it's, if I were running the agency, if that was my job, I'd want it to be zero.
I understand everybody wants it to be zero, but it may not be realistic to accomplish because you can't control it unless it's in your own house. But to accept a target that is 15% higher than the national average is to accept a target that admits that we're incapable of doing what other states are doing, and I'm not sure why that would be appropriate. Could we have a comment on that? Why should we, as a state, have targets for child abuse that our target is higher than the national average?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe that the 6.1 is the national average, but rather the national standard. There are a group of standards set nationally and then measured by the Child and Family Services Review. I'm not sure if we have somebody here that can talk about how other states have done specifically in this target area nationally, but in terms of passing the CFSR review nationally, states have not done that. And there are, again, there are a range of measures in there. This is but one of them. And Representative Wisnett, you're absolutely right. We would like this to be zero as well. we're trying to put something in there that we think we can achieve, and we always want that to be lower than it is.
Okay, but clarification, you're right. I mean, when I was reading national standard, I was thinking national averages. So if you're saying that, well, I mean, that there is a difference between those two terms and that our state is not substantially higher than the national average in our projections, I mean, as well as our performance, then I can see the difference.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to get more information and look at how we can revise the target downward.
Well, the target needs to be realistic. So not just asking for it to be lower, unless it's something that there's going to be a way to achieve. Yes.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma, and I'm today acting in the capacity of the performance measure manager for CAF. What we have taken a look at, and it's a very important distinction that is being made between a national standard and a national average, that we have, as we have looked at how other states are performing against this measure, what has become eminently clear is that we're comparing apples and oranges. And we have discovered in the last 90 days that we have some opportunities for changing the way and the things that we report as re-abuse that in essence are not re-abuse. For example, if a child comes into our care as a result of a report of abuse or neglect, sometimes that child discloses another incident of abuse or neglect. Oregon has been reporting that in some instances as a re-abuse, even though that's not a re-abuse that occurred after the child came to our attention. Rather, it's a reporting of a previous incidence of report of abuse. So in the next 90 days, we are working with the federal government to clean up the way that we report this, and we expect a significant improvement in what in our rate of re-abuse, which doesn't really change the re-abuse in actuality of what's happening. It merely changes what we are naming as re-abuse and better aligning it with what the national standard is expecting us to report.
Questions? Representative Boone?
Yeah, maybe I'm not understanding exactly what you're saying, but it sounds like the target and the goal for the department is being, you know, meeting this national number, but what happens if that, and regardless of the child, but what about if the child, you've missed something here, and in, say, something comes up and you say it's not a re-abuse, it's just another count of abuse, the point being to get the child to a safe place. And if that home is not a safe place, to get the child out of that home immediately, so you're not waiting for the third and final abuse, which will irrevocably damage or kill that child. In losing sight of, forget those federal numbers, but just focus on that child. That's my concern.
Chair Richardson, Representative Boone, again, I want to go back and make the distinction. In the past, some of the of what we have reported as re-abuse has not been re-abuse, meaning a second incident of abuse has occurred within 6 months after the first reported incident of re-abuse. Rather, the child comes to our attention and most likely comes into care as a result of that first report of abuse. And then what we do is collect information from the child about another previous abuse, and it's been miscoded in our system as a re-abuse.
So we're talking about the statistics are gathered,
okay,
which is separate from the reality of trying to help the families.
Okay.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I brought this up when we were in the Joint Committee. I think I started this conversation about, and really, in my mind, it doesn't matter how we measure particularly. It's about child safety. And for the public to read this and say our goal is something other than zero still doesn't sound right. if we know what the national standard is, we'll measure against the national standard continually. We'll measure against whatever level we finally come out at. But why can't the goal still be zero? Whether it's unrealistic or not to get to zero, we're all still working to get there. If you're still willing to say in the next 2 years you're going to move it from 7.6 to 7.5 to 7.3, you go in that direction, but the goal is still zero. The goal isn't to see how close you get to the number you pick, necessarily. We're still saying this is about child safety. Let's make the goal zero. I still don't quite understand.
Well, how do you do that? You got 3.5 million people here. You got how many families? And so what are you going to do? You can have that as a goal, but it's like saying let's have no hunger in the world. I mean, it's a nice goal to have, but how do you actually deal with that in a way that an agency can chart it, other than put it there so that the public sees that the goal's zero, but in reality what we're really doing, our internal measurement is going to be to improve by 10% or something like that. I mean, it is the reality versus the ideal.
Respectfully, follow up. I look at that and say, we know what the national standard is. We know if we're going to be, if we're worse than the national standard or better than the national standard, regardless of being able to ever achieve zero, just like your case of world hunger, wouldn't the goal, I mean, the goal's never going to be for us to sit around and say, gosh, we hope 10% of the world is hungry. I mean, if you say it in reverse, gee, we hope there, we'll be satisfied if there's 7.3% of the children re-abused. No, we'll be satisfied when zero of them are. That's just my point. If you use it in reverse in its term, it doesn't sound very nice. And that was my point then. It still is. So we know the national standards.
Is your recommendation, Representative, that the target be zero?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Representative Hansen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we can ever actually resolve this type of argument, because it's one of those half full, half empty kind of glass things where I'm more inclined to spill than. Anyway, I would think that the national standard is the real would be a workable goal, because that at least gives us something to measure from. If we may never get to zero, although that's certainly a laudable goal, but if we see that we're performing better than the national average,
you have a benchmark.
Yeah, and certainly if we're above the national average, then, or the national standard, then we should be very, very concerned as we are. But to start off with a goal that is in excess of the national standard, I think would be giving the real wrong signal. Obviously, we want to get to zero, but I don't. And we need to be able to measure, but we need to be able to measure that against some other standard.
Okay, I certainly understand the discussion. I'm against child abuse. I'm against child abuse. I'm against hunger. But as far as a budgetary matter and a performance measure that is going to be something that an agency comes back to in 2 years and they say, here's where we're at. I mean, if you think that it should be changed, we can change it. And make a recommendation to the full committee that it be a different number than what it is. This is such an important issue that what happens is that we go beyond what we're discussing to the philosophy, to the idea of the policy and for society. And I don't know if we're going to be able to resolve that, but if it makes us feel better, we can make a change in it. I just don't know if it's going to help the standard for the agency to achieve. But I'm open. I'm certainly not trying to, say that
that my view of this is better than anybody else. I'm just talking about it.
Well, in that light, maybe the people from the department can explain how you reach these numbers, and that would help us see how you're getting there. And I understand. I'm with him. I mean, I'd like to see it be zero too, and obviously you would too. That's part of your job. But how did we get to this number? And is it based on your statistics? And as long as we're headed downward towards zero, that's obviously should definitely be a side goal.
Would you like to respond?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families. And I would like to say, first of all, our practice goal is zero. I think that we support certainly the goal of seeing that no other children are re-abused, certainly after they've experienced one trauma. I believe that what Ms. Ledesma was trying to get at, I think it is an important issue, is that my program staff and I worked with a researcher on this re-abuse area, and one of the things that we found to be statistically significant was the error rate in the coding. And that is not to diminish the measure at all, but what we found is that in our attempts to be good record keepers, there were a statistically significant number of times that we might have had two callers on the same event, creating two referrals on the same event, founding on the same event. And on the line level staff, not understanding that in the state level, what that looked like is our abuse rate was increasing. The re-abuse, they were rather two referrals coded on the same event, which made it appear that there had been two events. In addition, though, the question that was asked is, how is the agency addressing child safety? And what are the measures we're taking to improve child safety? As all of you know, we've had a national expert review the child safety intervention system. And at the core of that study was really this issue of how is it that once we make contact with a family initially, we assure that we have adequate safety plans in place if we continue to work with families, or we have adequate assessment tools in place if we determine that the family has adequate protective capacity. We are in the midst of doing essentially an overhaul of our policy, our procedure, and our training, and reinforcing our staff as safety experts in the community, reinforcing that our supervisors have supervisor to worker ratio to supervise staff that do this kind of work. And we're also looking at this from a program aspect. We're looking at the re-abuse numbers month by month. Program staff are going to move in and work with each of the local offices to look at those numbers as they occur. And once we get beyond what may be an error in coding, I believe that we can really begin to address what may be any program or agency-related impact we can have on this number. As has been stated by the committee, there will be situations that will be beyond our control, but we are certainly taking every effort that we can right now to address this issue.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I would like to say something. That there's from a citizen standpoint, it's mm-hmm. a different issue as well, because it's a measurement factor. If you ask my dad, who's no longer here, may he rest in peace, what abuse was, the incidence would be much lower than the current standards that are given in now. I know of I read about a grandmother who, you know, the police were called and gets arrested because she popped a grandchild in who was errant in the grocery store. Because for some people, to spank a child with a pop is gross abuse. To my dad, that'd be like, you know, that's different. And so now it's a measurement issue as to what's abuse and what isn't. If you read the definition of abuse, it's also emotional abuse. Well, how much yelling at a child becomes emotional abuse, and who makes that determination? Because it's a very subjective thing. I had a constituent just 2 weeks ago who had their children taken from their home because they'd gone through a very hard birth, and a baby had been really beat up in this birth, bad birth. And the child went to Dornbecker, And the single note on this baby got sent to a child welfare worker, and nobody asked the attending physician about the birth. But it looked like this child had been abused, and it was only, you know, like a week or two old. Well, they just went in and took the kids. That family came apart because there was no history of abuse, and all of a sudden, the huge machine of the government has come in and taken their children from their home and said, you're abusive, and we're taking these kids. And so they hire a lawyer. They spend $2,500. They call us. It finally gets looked at. They look at the other notes. They get the other medic records, and they say, oh, well, it wasn't abuse after all. Well, for the family, there's abuse in the fact that these children are traumatized because they're taken from their homes. And so in talking to the head of the Medford office, I said, I understand where you're coming from. It's very difficult. If a child is abused and you don't take action, then why in the world did the agency not have a zero tolerance for abuse? But on the other hand, if you go in and take the children out and you don't have support for doing that action, then look at the heavy-handed arm of the government breaking into families. And what's the cost to families of having their kids pulled out? And so it is a very difficult thing to deal with, because when are you going too far and when are you not going far enough? And sometimes you don't know until there's a child that's killed, or you know, they've got these parents saying, look at what these workers are doing, they're just busting up families. And so it's a very difficult position that you're in. And I don't know how, from a practical standpoint, you can ever really do more than what you're doing, other than to assure that your people are well trained, that there are that there is a procedure so that if something has gone wrong, the parents cannot feel like they're getting nowhere. This was a Hispanic family, and they felt like they were getting no voice, that it was just being handled. And so once it got looked at, then things worked out, and I was grateful for the response of the agency in very quickly taking a look at it. Mickey Cerise has got to be one of the most overworked person in this building, because I know everybody calls and says, we got this problem. But the problem is part of the nature of what you're confronted with, as the power of the government has to be balanced against the respect for our family. And I'm not interested in having the government say, this qualifies and this doesn't qualify. There has to be more of a totalitarian view and respecting families. But when is the line crossed? Well, who are you going to talk to? For some, it's the line's pretty high, and for some, it's pretty low, and it's not an easy thing. We, as a committee, want to be assured that the goal is not just on paper, but that there is active work at what can be done, what can be learned from other states and other organizations to help and direct our efforts in a way to be more sensitive to parents, but sensitive to the needs of children, and working to help parents be better trained, to help have respite situations where people are getting too upset or, you know, too angry, and there's some place for them to go, not just let it blow up and then it becomes very physical. There's so many different aspects of it, and that's your jobs, and we know that you take it very seriously. And so once again, though, this whole discussion goes far beyond Measure 14, but it's a very important one. Yes, sir.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the interim director of the Department of Human Services. I'd like to shed a different opinion on this, if I might. One of the reasons we're asking we look to you for the establishment of these performance measures is to be accountable ourselves for our effectiveness as an organization, our effectiveness as a management group, and our effectiveness as providers of service. So if you were to set, for example, as Representative Hansen suggests, the national standard, then we would measure ourselves against that standard. The cold and unfortunate reality is that reabuse is going to occur. We live in a society where that is something that is either occurring today or will occur tomorrow, but will occur sometime in Oregon, just as it occurs sometime in every state in the union. Now, the question is are our efforts aimed at appropriately making it as little as is possible? Are we getting as close to the overall goal of zero as we can? And if we're not getting to 6.1, then we're not at the national standard. That's the standard that's been established by the folks who have done the research and, you know, reviewed what's possible in the society we live in. If you set the standard at zero, what you are saying to us is, we know you cannot achieve the standard. You know, because we're not going to be at zero.
cold reality of 21st century life in America is we're not going to be at zero on that issue. Now, we need performance standards that we can hold ourselves accountable to, and that's why the one is in front of you, and LFO is established with our assistance where it should be. If you want to move it to 6.1, that makes sense, but we will try and respond as you deem appropriate.
Thank you very much. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment about that. You sound as though you don't like zero, but you're saying the agency set it at 7.5, which is 23% higher than the 6.1, which is the national standard.
That's before he got here, though.
Well, but I mean, think about the logic of that. It's if you're willing to be 23% higher than the national standard today, are you willing to move to the national standard?
Well, the national standard, I would hope, as I'm sure you do, Representative Chair Richardson, that the national standard continues to move, and that we would hope that it continues to move downward. And, you know, next year perhaps the national standard would be at 5, and maybe next biennium when we're having this conversation, we've set ours at 6, that we think we can get to 6. But the issue is to what level shall we hold ourselves accountable for the efforts we do with the families in Oregon to prevent this kind of reabuse from occurring.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I would move to change the number to 6.1, if that's through support.
Okay, there's a motion that we change performance measure 14 standard to 6.1. Discussion on that motion? Is there objection to that motion? Okay. Representative Hanna is opposed to this motion. Is there anyone else?
Well, I'm not objecting. I missed you when you hit the discussion. But
it's fine for us. We don't have
okay.
to move at all. You know.
No, and I agree. I'm, obviously, the target should be zero, and I think that maybe there's at least for me too. It's all in the words, and if we say that maybe, and that people realize that, and understanding that you know nobody is perfect, and we continue to go toward perfection, I think that message is stronger. And you need numbers, so at least, in my opinion, we should be at least aiming for that national standard with the ultimate goal of being, you know, below it. Don't hit 6.1 and say, okay, we're there, you know, and quit, so which we know you're not going to do. So.
Yeah. All right. Further discussion? All right. Is there anyone? If there's no one else opposed, then the record will indicate that Representative Hanna is a no, and the motion carries. So performance measure 14 will have a standard of 6.1, and that's what we'll work toward until we can get past it. We want to have the Oregon standard. Of course, then it's back to what's the definition. All right. Well, we've got... If there's no other questions or issues on the performance measures, let's go to budget notes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the budget notes that I've identified for the Children, Adults, and Families budget are ones that were already approved and put into other agency budgets. The first relates to the jobs plus individual education account that we talked about. The reason that there are funds available to transfer to offset general fund in this budget is that clients have not used all of their benefits from that within the five-year time limit. And the House Education Subcommittee added a budget note to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget, basically that said, we want you to look at why those clients aren't using their benefits as much as they could, and then to report back on efforts to improve the utilization of that. I would note that in the program overall, the participation in the Jobs Plus program and therefore the number of clients that would benefit as a result of that have been declining over time, but it's still an issue in terms of those clients who are participating, how many of them actually access those benefits within the five-year time limit. And so that's what the first budget note relates to. The second one involves a look at child care regulation and services at the state level. Employment Department is the lead agency in the state in terms of receiving the federal child care funds and allocating those with assistance of the Child Care Commission and numerous other community partners. But this budget note would ask that department, the Department of Human Services, and then the Commission on Children and Families, to look at how those funds and programs are structured in the state, look at both the regulation side and the services side, and then to report back to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and the substantive committees no later than fall of 2006. With the intention being, if there are some recommendations, that it would be useful to move forward either into a governor's budget or a legislative budget, or that need legislation, that timing then would allow that to happen.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the chair and Ms. Baker, or both. On the second budget note, is it appropriate, and could it be put in there to? I think it's important that the local county arms of this be involved in that discussion or that review. Otherwise, you're getting opinions strictly from policymakers up here, not the people delivering the services. So that's my comment. I think that the review should include local providers at the county level.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, I think that the agencies can consider that and involve the counties as well. I wouldn't recommend at this point changing the budget note, since it's already in the Employment Department's budget as is, but we can certainly in the narrative of the budget report note that that was a concern for the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion on what's been discussed by presented to us today before we take a motion on this bill? The signal to the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that this subcommittee take LFO's recommendations and approve the performance measures with the changes as noted in the budget notes as presented above.
Okay, would you mind making a more detailed
motion? Oh, we have to do all the money, too?
All the money.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we accept LFO's recommendations to the subcommittee and approve a preliminary budget of $424,146,979 general funds, $132,831,483 other funds, $765,610,272 federal funds, $950,548,580 non-limited federal funds, and 4,094 positions, which is 3,975.5 FTE for children, adults, and families, and a $2,500,000 general fund special purpose appropriation to the Emergency Board for Child Welfare Staffing and Legal Representation Issues. Further, Mr. Chair, I recommend the subcommittee approve the LFO recommendations concerning the performance measures with the one change. And the budget notes is presented above.
Representative Wisnett makes a recommendation that we accept LFO's recommendations to the subcommittee relating to the Children, Adult, and Families budget in the numbers that he has presented, including the $2.5 million general fund special purpose appropriation to the Emergency Board, as well as acceptance of the performance measures with the single amendment that we've discussed and made. As noted, as well as the budget notes that were presented. This is their discussion. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you have the maker of the motion repeat that? I may have missed one.
A little sub-motion.
Nice friend.
Is there any other discussion? Is there anyone opposed to the motion? If not, then it's unanimously carried, and the CAF segment of the VHS budget is approved. Thank you all for your help today. And for all the work that you're doing, by the way, we don't say it enough, you know, we kind of nitpick, but everyone here is here because they care. And we appreciate the hard work that you do and those that you supervise. You represent thousands of concerned public servants all across the state who have a very difficult job. And no matter what they do, half the time they're going to be wrong as far as someone is concerned. And it's not easy. And we understand that. We appreciate very much all that you're doing. Thank you.
I would like to add to that, too, and thank you all for your patience with us, because you really are the experts here, and you have to sit there and nod and smile and accept what we say and answer our questions, and I really appreciate it. I have a little bit of a background in this area, but nothing close to what you do, and I can't imagine daily, this job's hard enough. I can't imagine. It makes our job look simple. So thank you very much.
Is there further... Well, we've ended that work session, and before we terminate, is there something you'd like to bring up?
Well, just the philosophy on that we've kind of got into. I have no problems in terms of an agency that errs in being extra aggressive in preventing abuse to children. It's the way the agency responds to the errors that they make that I think is the critical point in terms of how they should be judged. I can remember a situation where my son had some insect bites or something, and it looked like he'd went three rounds with Sonny Liston, and we had to keep him in the house for 3 days, or else I'm sure we would have been charged. But in a situation like that, anybody that would have looked at that kid and said, "Gee, I think abuse has happened," I could understand that. But and I wouldn't be offended as a parent if somebody was concerned enough about my child that they took action. It's how the agency deals with it, and how if it's clearly a mistake, how they deal with rectifying the mistake so that people don't have to pay $2,500 to a lawyer to clear their good name or to get their kids back.
Thank you. Further comment? Not, we are adjourned.